Chapter 26. Sky had slipped into a deep slumber by the time Austin had crawled into the warm auberge feather bed. She clung to his side throughout the night, her sleep frequently disturbed by feverish murmurings of red death and dark water. Austin's nerves were on edge as well. Several times he pried himself loose from Sky's hot grip and went to the window. Except for the moths fluttering around the inn's lighted sign, all was still. But Austin was far from complacent. The Fauchard family had a long reach. After a fitful night's sleep, they were awakened by bright sunlight flooding their room. They put on the terry cloth bathrobes that Sky found in a closet, and they had breakfast sent up to their room. Austin had tossed their tattered costumes into the trash. They recruited the maid who brought their food and sent her to shop for clothes. Fortified with a cup of strong coffee, Sky regained her usual sparkle, but Chateau Fauchard still weighed heavily on her mind. "Should we report the Fauchard to the authorities?" she asked. "The Fauchards are a rich and powerful family," Austin said. "That doesn't mean they're above the law," she said. "I agree with you. What part of our story do you think would the police believe? The pit in the pendulum or the cask of Amontillado? If we make a fuss, we might even be accused of stealing Emil's plane."
"I see what you mean," she said with a frown.
"Well, then what do we do?"
"Go back to Paris. Regroup. Dig out every bit of dirt we can on the Fauchards." Austin cleared his throat. "Who's going to tell your friend Darnay that his bullet-riddled Rolls-Royce is at the bottom of a castle moat?"
"I'll inform him.
Don't worry, Charles was thinking of turning it in for a Bentley. He'll simply report it stolen."
Her lips widened in her usual sunny smile. "Knowing Charles, I'd guess it was stolen to begin with."
A dark cloud cast a shadow over her smile.
"Do you believe what that poor Englishman Cavendish said? That the Fauchards started World War I and had at least some responsibility for the Second World War?"
Austin chewed on the question along with a bite of croissant.
"Dunno. It takes more than a few people to start a war. Hubris, stupidity, and miscalculation play a big role."
"True. But think about it, Kurt. In 1914, the great powers were led by some of the most inept leaders in history. The decision to start war was in the hands of a few people. None were particularly intelligent. A czar or a kaiser didn't have to ask his people for permission to go to war. Couldn't a small, wealthy, and determined group like the Fauchard and other arms manufacturers manipulate these leaders, play off their deficiencies, and influence their decisions? Then provide an event like the Grand Duke's assassination that would start the shooting?
Certainly possible. World War II was a different situation, but you had the same volatile mixture waiting for a spark to trigger the explosion."
"Then you do think there is something to the charges?"
"Now that I've met the Fauchards, Mayor and Fils, I would agree that if anyone could start a war, it would be them. The murderous way they reacted when Cavendish shot his mouth off speaks volumes."
She shivered as she recalled the Englishman's demise.
"Cavendish claimed that Jules Fauchard was trying to stop the war," Sky said. "We know he only got as far as the Dormieux Glacier. If he had made it across the Alps, he would have landed in Switzerland."
"I see where you're going. A neutral country where he could have revealed to the world what his family was plotting."
He paused. "Let's think about it. Fauchard was rich and influential, but he would need proof to make his case. Documents or secret papers?"
"Of course," Sky said. "The strong box that Jules was carrying with him. The Fauchard didn't want their dirty little family secret getting out."
"I'm still puzzled," Austin said after a moment's thought. "Say we manage to exhume Jules' body and salvage incriminating documents. The Fauchards could weather the bad publicity. They would hire a high-priced PR firm to put spin on the story. They could say that the documents were forgeries. Outside of a few historians, I'm not sure if anybody would care so long after the fact."
"Then why did they resort to flooding the tunnel, kill Renault, and try to kill us?"
"Here's another theory. Let's suppose Spear Industries is on the verge of a big deal. A merger. A new product. Maybe even a new war, he said with a wry grin. Headlines about the family's unsavory past could spoil their plans. That would make sense, she said. What doesn't make sense is why Jules had the helmet with him. The Fauchards are eccentric, she ventured. You're being kind, Austin said with a frown. They are homicidal maniacs, but they don't act without a purpose. I think that the Fauchards were not simply worried about their family history being exposed. They desperately wanted to retrieve the helmet. There is something about that old steel pot that is of great importance to them. We have to find out what it is. Perhaps Charles has made progress in his examination. I must go see him as soon as I can. A knock at the door interrupted their discussion. The maid had returned from her mission with shopping bags in hand. Austin had some cash and credit cards along with his passport in a neck wallet. He gave the maid a substantial tip, and then he and Skye tried on their new outfits. The red dress fit Skye's trim figure like a fine glove. Austin tried on his black slacks and white shirt. Conservative, but they wouldn't attract attention. The clerk called a car rental for them, and while the Peugeot they rented was no Rolls, the drive back to Paris through the sunny countryside helped clear away the lingering cobwebs from the Fauchard catacombs. Austin kept a heavy foot on the gas. The more distance he put between them and the chateau, the better. Austin launched into the Marseillaise when he saw the spike of the Eiffel Tower looming in the distance. A short while later, they were in Paris. Austin swung by Skye's apartment, and she called the antiques dealer to let him know she was coming to Provence. Darnay was delighted to hear her plans, saying they had much to discuss. Skye packed an overnight bag, and Austin dropped her off at the railroad station, where she kissed him on both cheeks before boarding a train south. The hotel desk clerk smiled broadly when Austin came up for his key.
Ah, Monsieur Austin, we are so glad to have you back. A gentleman has been waiting here for some time to see you.
He glanced toward the lobby. A figure was stretched out in a comfortable leather chair, apparently asleep. A copy of Le Figaro covered his face. Austin went over, lifted the paper, and saw the dark complexioned features of Joe Zavala. Austin tapped Zavala's shoulder.
Hotel security, he said in an Inspector Clouseau accent. You'll have to come along with me.
Zavala blinked his eyes open.
About time.
Feeling's mutual, old pal. I thought you were in the Alps improving Franco-American relations. Zavala sat up in the chair.
Denise wanted me to meet her parents. That's always a bad sign. Where have you been? I tried calling, but there was no answer on your cell.
Austin flopped down in a chair. There's a good explanation for that. My cell phone is at the bottom of a castle moat.
I must admit that's one excuse I've never heard before. Should I ask how it got there?
Long story. What was so urgent that you had to camp out in a hotel lobby? Zavala's face became uncharacteristically somber.
Rudy called me when he couldn't reach you.
Rudy Gunn was Pitt's second in command.
There's been an accident at the Lost City site.
Paul and Gamay dove in the Alvin.
They never came up. There was a pilot aboard, too.
Oh, hell, Austin said. What happened?
No one seems to know. There was an attack on the research vessel at about the same time they lost contact with the submersible.
Doesn't make sense. Who would attack a peaceful scientific expedition?
You got me.
I took a fast train to Paris last night, planted myself here and checked with the poor desk clerk every 15 minutes. How long have they been missing?
More than 24 hours without contact.
I assume Dirk and Rudy have been alerted. Zavala nodded.
Dirk wants us to keep him posted. He's called on the Navy for help. I talked to Rudy a half hour ago.
He sent the research vessel searcher in so we could hear something at any minute. What's the life support situation on the Alvin?
About 48 hours of food and air left.
Zavala glanced at his watch. Austin silently cursed. While he'd been dallying over croissants with Skye, the Trouts, if they were still alive, were in desperate need of help. We have to move fast. There's a NUMA executive jet at De Gaulle Airport. We can be in the Azores in a few hours, and Rudy's arranged transportation for the next leg of the trip. Austin told Zavala to stay put while he went up to his room. He shed his new wardrobe in exchange for his standard uniform of jeans and sweater, then threw some clothes in a duffel bag and was back in the lobby within minutes. The jet was warming its engines when they arrived at the airport. After a fast trip to the Azores, they hopped onto a seaplane and headed out into the Atlantic. The NUMA research vessel Searcher had been on its way home from Europe when Gunn's call diverted it to the mid-Atlantic ridge. Austin was glad to learn that the Searcher was on site. The research vessel was only a few months old, and it was crammed with state-of-the-art remote sensing equipment and undersea robots. As the seaplane began its descent, Austin looked out the window and saw that the Navy had lost no time reacting to Pitt's request. The NUMA vessel and the Atlantis had been joined by a Navy cruiser. The seaplane touched down on the water near the sleek-hulled NUMA vessel. Alerted by the seaplane pilot, the Searcher had a boat waiting to shuttle Austin and Zavala to the ship. The skipper, a tall, olive-skinned Californian named Paul Gutierrez, was waiting for them. Captain Gutierrez wasted little time and led them to the bridge. In the wheelhouse, Austin's coral-colored eyes stared off at the sea, where a powerboat was approaching the Atlantis from the Navy ship. Looks like we're about to have company. The Navy arrived within hours. They've been keeping an eye out for further attacks. Let me show you what we've been doing. He spread out a chart of the area. Sections of the chart were cross-hatched with a black grease pencil. We've been lucky with weather conditions. This will give you an idea of the area we've covered. We've run sonar surveys and sent down our remote-operated vehicles. Impressive. Thanks. The Searcher's gear can spot a dime at 1,000 fathoms. We've covered the entire lost city and some of the outlying areas where we discovered more fields of hydrothermal vents. The Atlantis has been checking out the ridge as well. The capabilities of the Searcher are awesome, if I say so myself. He shook his head. Can't figure it. The Alvin's one of the toughest little subs in the world. She's gone down hundreds of times without a problem. No sign of the submersible so far. No Alvin, but that's not the end of the story. Gutierrez handed Austin a printout showing the bottom as seen on the sonar monitor. Once we covered the lost city, we began to look beyond the immediate area. There are at least 3 other vent cities of comparable or larger size located on the ridge. Check out what we found in one of them, which we're calling LC2. It's got us baffled as hell. Austin borrowed a magnifying glass. Years of survey work had given him a skilled eye in reading sonar, but the markings he saw were puzzling. What are these strange double lines? We wondered the same thing. So we sent down an ROV and shot these pictures. Austin studied the glossy 8x10 photos. The tall columns of the lost city were clearly defined, as were the tracks that wound through the towers. They look like tread marks from a big bulldozer or a tank, Austin said. Very big, the captain said. When we used the columns for scale, we estimated that the treads must have been at least 30 feet apart. What's the depth here? 2,500 feet. Zavala whistled. A respectable engineering feat, but not impossible. Remind you of something, Kurt? Big John, Austin said with a smile. In answer to the captain's quizzical expression, he explained that Big John was the nickname for a bottom-crawling vehicle NUMA had developed several years before as a moving deep-ocean lab. He pointed to a photo that showed the tracks coming to an abrupt end. Whatever was down there seems to have lifted off. Unlike Big John, this mechanical turtle can swim as well as crawl. And my guess is that it took the Alvin with it, Zavala said. It seems too much of a coincidence having the Alvin disappear near these tracks, Captain Gutierrez said. There was another strange coincidence, Austin said. I understand you were attacked at about the same time as the Alvin's disappearance. As we were starting to panic about the Alvin, we were approached by a strange ship, Gutierrez said. It was an old rust bucket of a freighter. The name on the hull was the Celtic Rainbow, and it was out of Malta. They called in a mayday. When we returned the call, there was no answer. Only the distress call, repeating over and over again. Then we sighted smoke, apparently coming from a hold. Did anyone try to abandon the ship? That's what was crazy. No one. Not a soul on the deck. I was going to send a boat to investigate, but Captain Beck volunteered to go over with a party of his men. Beck. He ran an ocean security outfit. As you may know, pirates have attacked or threatened research vessels around the world. The institution was working with Beck to set up security procedures for its research vessels. He had three men, all former SEALs like himself, on board for a training mission. They'd been teaching crew and scientists how to react to a pirate attack. He struck me as a very capable man. None better, said a man in a Navy uniform who had stepped into the pilot house. From what I've heard, Beck was a real pro. I'm Ensign Pete Muller. That's my ship over there, he said, pointing to the cruiser. Austin extended his hand. Nice to meet you, Ensign. Always a pleasure to talk to folks from NUMA. What happened to Captain Beck and his men? Austin said. I'm afraid they were all killed, the ensign said. I'm very sorry to hear that. We found the captain's body in the water, but no sign of his men or the ship, Muller said. How could a freighter simply disappear? Our ship was the closest vessel when the Atlantis sent out the SOS. By the time we arrived, the attackers were gone. We secured the situation here, then we chased after the attackers. We knew which direction they had gone in, and with our superior speed, we would have overtaken them. We had them on radar when the blip disappeared. We found debris and an oil slick, but no ship. I don't get it, Austin said. SEALs are among the most highly trained special warfare people on the face of the Earth. Boarding a potentially hostile ship is one of their specialties. I'm afraid they ran into something they never trained for. Austin noticed something in Ensign Muller's expression that he rarely saw in the face of a military man. It was the look of fear. I have the feeling that there is more here than I've been told. Maybe the captain can tell us about the attack. I can do better than that, Gutierrez said. I'll let you see it.